Good evening. I'm Dr. Elaine Schroeder. Welcome to Mind Over Matter, a monthly K2 radio show that explores issues of our minds as well as our hearts. The act of suicide has touched most people's lives, and perhaps it was a family member or a friend who took their own life, or a parent could be worried about their depressed teen who was thinking possibly of harming themselves, perhaps like a classmate had done earlier in the year. Or maybe you yourself have struggled with depression and you've thought about suicide. Tonight, we're going to explore suicide through the lens of the Juno Suicide Prevention Coalition and a police officer. So in the studio this evening, I have with me Lieutenant Chris Sell of the Juno Police Department, who is also a member of the Suicide Prevention Coalition in Juno. Welcome.
Thank you.
Welcome
nice
to our
here.
Program. Yes. Chris, let me tell folks, I always interview my guests before, before the show, usually a day or two before the show, and I just found Chris's background really interesting. And so would you mind telling us what you did? I mean, kind of, you're now a celebrity in Juno.
Oh, geez.
Sort of. Well, the Year of Kindness, I'd
right.
say, has really been big. And you won Citizen of the Year in 2016, right?
Yes.
Okay, Juno Citizen of the Year. So I think, you know, a lot of people know you. What were you doing before you became a police officer?
Well, before I became a police officer, for a few years I did sell real estate, and I did that after I starved out of broadcasting.
But you grew up on a farm
I
in
did.
Montana.
I did.
Okay,
I
got to tell that. In the middle of nowhere. Okay.
It wasn't exactly the middle of nowhere, but the town, my hometown was 8,000 people, and I grew up on a little farm near there. And looking back, of course, it was a wonderful place to grow up. However, as a teenager, I came to believe I was imprisoned upon the farm and could not wait to get out and take on the world and leave Montana. But it was a wonderful place to grow up, and I did get my first paycheck job was as an easy-listening country music disc jockey in Kalispell, Montana. And I have to admit, I had quite the following amongst the dairy farmers.
So you're really comfortable here tonight in front of the mic.
Well, this is back to my roots, is back in radio.
Uh-huh. Okay, so I'm sorry, I interrupted you. So you tell me some... You started in real estate, then you.
Well, I was in real estate after I got tired of macaroni and cheese, which is what went with broadcasting.
Oh,
sometimes I could afford some tuna to mix into it.
Okay, so you were in broadcasting.
I was in broadcasting right out of college. First in radio, I was at public radio at the University of Montana. Then I went into television, and I had
public radio.
Yeah.
Oh,
yeah,
you're here.
That was before I went into television and had a big perm and sparkly blue eyeshadow and shoulder pads.
Oh, God, what I love
it
to
was,
see
oh,
you.
It was just hilarious.
I love that.
Just hilarious. Shoulder pads big enough. I mean, I'm not a small woman anyway, but I took up the whole screen.
They probably look like a football uniform there.
Well, I'm sure the local farmers were impressed that it looked like I could carry a 5-gallon bucket of water in each hand. That was kind of a big deal in Montana.
Yeah. Did you go to University of Montana for journalism?
I did. I have a broadcasting degree from the University of Montana.
Yeah, I know. They have a good...
Great program.
Journalism program.
Even the fictional character in A River Runs Through It, played by Brad Pitt, went to the University of Montana.
Ooh, okay.
That's as close as I ever got to Brad Pitt.
Okay. So after real estate, then what happened? How did you get into police work?
Well, after real estate, I found... law enforcement is really my true calling, and it was a lot like journalism because you run to the sound of what's going on and you write a really involved story about it. It's just in police work, sometimes I have to wrestle somebody when I'm there.
Oh.
And that didn't happen in journalism. So it's a very similar tempo to your work. You do a lot of writing. But police work was really my niche in the world. And when you find that place, it's like a puzzle piece clicking in, and you just know it's right. This is my destiny.
Oh, wonderful.
And I really, my wish is that everybody finds that for their career.
Yeah.
Because it's a wonderful place to be.
Yeah, and did you start out as a rookie on the Juneau Police Force?
Oh, yes.
You started right away in Juneau?
Juneau's the only place I've ever worked as a police officer. Went to the academy in 97 and then worked in patrol, became a detective, got promoted to sergeant, and I've been a lieutenant for quite some time.
So how many years have you been here?
Over 19 years now.
On the force?
Mm-hmm.
Okay,
almost
good.
20 now.
Okay. Well, great. Now, you are on the Suicide Prevention. You're in the Suicide Prevention Coalition.
That's correct.
How did you end up there?
I was one of the first members when we first formed the coalition, and it had to do with a year where we'd had a number of youth suicides kind of grouped together, and that created a great deal of alarm in the community. Though the numbers were not terribly out of line from what we normally see in a year, it was the demographic of the people who had taken their own lives and really the community's concern about that. So the coalition started, and through just incredible dedication from people showing up month after month, we have continued after the crisis phase, because it's always easy to stand up some sort of community response when everybody's upset about something. The hard work is 3 and 4 and 5 and 6 years later, where you're keeping structures in place to respond to suicide events and to do suicide prevention.
So what do you think caused, how long ago did that blip happen?
I'm sorry that I'm getting older now and I don't remember, you know, it seems like it was just a few years ago,
okay.
But it was probably 7 or 8 years ago.
I kind of remember.
Walter Majoris chaired it for a long time.
Right, and I probably remember it because I was in private practice at the time.
Okay.
And I would be quite aware of a suicide epidemic,
right,
or whatever you want to call it. And was it like that, where there was copycat suicides? Do you think it was that?
No, it was. That was really one of the difficulties in addressing this issue, is they weren't related and they weren't copycats. It was like lightning had struck a bunch of different households in Juneau,
okay,
and this had happened. But they weren't associated with each other, and that continues to be the challenge in addressing suicide, is that they don't have anything in common as far as how to address a certain group. You may have some groupings, but really it's in every neighborhood. It's in every socioeconomic demographic. It's with every gender, every age. Though we do see some spikes, like with Alaska Native males. Their rate is very high.
Yeah. And so who's on the coalition?
The coalition has people from many of the social service agencies, as well as clergy and mental health care providers.
Yeah.
I've been a liaison from JPD since the start. And then some people will come and go from different agencies. NAMI often has someone there. JAMI, when they can get away. All of these agencies, of course, have their own staffing issues.
Sure.
And so sometimes
it costs money.
It may be soft dollars, but it still costs money to get somebody to these meetings and to these situations that we have to meet about when we've learned of a completed suicide.
So how many people are on the coalition?
Oh, there's got to be. It fluctuates between about 10 and 15.
When I was talking to you, you said you were on the postvention subcommittee.
Yes, there's a subcommittee.
What is that? What does that mean, postvention?
Postvention means that once we learn that there's been a completed suicide, we meet, and the postvention committee decides what, if anything, we're going to do in this situation. Now, sometimes we come to the conclusion that we're not going to do anything, that the affected people have lots of social resources, they're not going to welcome our contact, and there's nothing that we can help with in that situation. Sometimes we may look at a situation and think, okay, maybe this young was someone who used to be associated with a group like Juneau Youth Services, or they used to get services from NAMI.
Yes.
Then we start to look at those partners or other partners we learn of that maybe have a connection with someone who was close to the completed suicide. what we know is that nobody wants a helpful, well-meaning stranger to knock on their door after such an incredibly personal tragedy is having a loved one take their own life. So we avoid that at all costs.
So what do you do?
Well, what we do is we find the person who can talk to someone close to the situation and find out what support or what information might that person need. Who else is at risk? We'll address requests like, I remember a young boy who'd taken his own life had other young people that were in the Boy Scouts with him. And so they wanted some support during that time. So we help arrange for that and who's going to go talk to them and what resources might they need.
Who do you bring in? Do you bring in somebody from the mental health clinic? Or
It depends on the situation and who has a prior relationship with that group and who's the appropriate person to meet with them. Who are they comfortable with? So we try and meet their requests for, you know, what is it that you would like out of this meeting? Sometimes it's like a SISM type information.
Yes. Ellis explained SISM. Critical
Go on. Oh, so critical incident stress management is just an educational process where basically normal people have been exposed to a very abnormal event, and that can have some physical and emotional and mental symptoms. And there's a long list of symptoms, and I have some personal favorites that I tend to embrace after a traumatic event.
Oh, you mean
all know who've been in emergency services. We know that
an occupational hazard of yours.
Right. And so maybe I talk to some groups about, okay, these are some things you might experience. I tend to like to embrace the sleeplessness side after a traumatic event.
Mm-hmm.
There are different things, or being more irritable with people, being more short-tempered, just because you're stressed about what happened. So we try and let people know this is some of the things that normal people can experience after an abnormal event. And there's nothing wrong with it, but if these symptoms go on for more than about 72 hours, it's helpful to get some support with that.
I was so sorry when I was running the hospice bereavement group for mm-hmm. many, many years that we didn't have the population to be able to run a specific group for people whose loved ones had committed suicide.
Right.
Because I'd have to have in the group everything from a widow whose husband died at 89 to parents who lost their children from natural causes to a wife whose husband committed suicide. And it worked, but it didn't work as well. And I had always wished we could, and that's what they'll do in a big city. You'll have a group for survivors, the family of people who have completed a suicide.
What we do on the postvention committee is really what I consider a SWAT team-like response to the incident. We don't have a formula for what we do after each incident because every incident is different and the needs of the people closest to the person that was lost are different. So we meet and we come up with a tactical response because it's different when you have a suicide of a young person versus an elder suicide or a suicide of a person that was a little bit disenfranchised, and we need to see if we can find where their loss is impacting others.
Yeah. Do you have any idea how many suicides occur in Juneau a year?
I looked at the 2016 statistics in preparation for this show, and we had 7 confirmed suicides. And there was an 8th death that was an overdose with suicide overtones, which is fairly common. So I would have to say our rate from 2016 was 8, which is roughly double the national average for suicide.
Really?
Yes. The national,
in Juneau?
In Juneau. And so it's not – sometimes we think of suicide as being particularly – epidemic in rural Alaska, but it's also in urban Alaska. We are not exempt. The national average for suicide is 12 in every 100,000 population. That means Juneau should have, what, my math fails me, like four should be our average compared to nationally.
Yes.
And we were double that for 2016.
Okay, so that's 1 year.
Right.
What about if you take the last 10 years and did an average?
Sure. I would have to get the statistics for that, but I would say working on these calls and you know being part of the first responder community, that's really not an unusual rate for us. That feels pretty normal. When I did ask our crime analyst to look at all of the cases that reference suicide. And there were 85 cases for 2016.
Oh, that referenced suicide.
Right.
What does that
mean?
Right,
and so it's a suicidal person. It's someone who is threatened suicide. Basically, one call every 4 days.
That's a lot of police time.
It's a lot of police time that we put into the issue of trying to help people who are suicidal, though it's not a crime. And so sometimes people don't realize how much of our public safety duties have to do with trying to keep people safe, sometimes from themselves.
So tell me what happens. Give me some background on the suicide attempts that you intervene in. How does it work?
Well, suicide, sometimes it's a really dramatic attempt, like they've stepped on the other side of the railing on the Juno Douglas Bridge. And we end up negotiating with them, trying to get them to a safe place. And then sometimes it's not quite that advanced where someone is talking about what they would do. And you have explored with them, you know, have you thought about how exactly you would do this? Maybe they've articulated they have an actual plan, which means they're a little more advanced in their thinking on this. And we often take people under what's called a Title 47 hold. And that's a peace officer's hold that allows us to take someone to Bartlett Regional Hospital where they are required to meet with a clinician. Now, even though we can do that against someone's will, we try and give people as much dignity and as much authority in that process as we can. Because, of course, they're going to do better with the clinician if we haven't had to restrain them and cause them additional angst before they talk to someone.
So who calls you about a case like that?
Oh, everybody. Family members, neighbors. Sometimes people are yelling things on the street at themselves
I'll
or
kill
each
myself,
other. Yes.
Or...
people driving by will see someone on the bridge. Or, you know, someone removing their clothes on the docks, like they're going to jump in. The calls come from really everywhere, and sometimes it's just activity an officer sees when they're out patrolling.
What about, do you get many calls, say, from parents who are, I'm just wondering, they probably could call you because they can't bring their teenager, let's say, into the hospital. And you would have more authority to do that.
Sure. I mean, I remember a night where I'd gone suicide call to suicide call. And first I had to restrain a woman who'd already slashed one arm. And I was trying not to hurt her, but she actually clocked me pretty good with the arm she'd already injured. And so we got her restrained, and one of the other officers took her to the hospital, and I got called to a teenage boy who had taken a bottle of an over-the-counter medication in a suicidal gesture.
Yeah.
That after having a disagreement with his parents, and I told them we're going to the hospital, and he did get his stomach pumped, but I remember he looked at me and said, "Are you kidding?" And it's like, I think I was disheveled from this fight I already had, and I said, "Does it look like I'm kidding, young man?" So there have been nights where it's just call the call when for the patrol officers. And, you know, sometimes we'll get groupings of them. It seems like when the sun comes out, strangely enough, we'll get a surge of that type of activity.
What do you think that's about?
I don't know. I don't know if people who are depressed get enough energy at that point that they actually start acting on some plans.
Uh-huh.
Or if everybody starts feeling better when the sun comes out, but
and
they
don't. That's what I think,
so
it might be the latter.
You know, we've speculated about both of those because I think just about anybody that works in first response has noticed kind of the sunshine poisoning that happens when it does stop raining in Juneau.
Well, absolutely. And to make a strange analogy, I've seen couples divorce after they've taken a vacation. And the reason is that their expectation is they're in paradise and they still can't get along.
Right.
And the person on a beautiful sunny day watching everybody in Juneau glorying in this wonderful weather, and they feel miserable.
And they're just so, I can see being disheartened because they're still not feeling any better.
Yeah. Do you see any connection between homicide and suicide? Especially in an older population, because you mentioned somebody ranting on the street.
Right. I think that there's always going to be a little bit of blurring in that area because suicide is often rage turned inward, and homicide is rage turned outward.
Exactly.
So I think that it depends on the target. Something that we also talk to police officers about is that someone who's suicidal doesn't care if they take you with them or not.
Mm-hmm.
That's why we don't want officers jumping into the channel after someone who's thrown themselves in. We want them to, you know, get the Coast Guard response and you know, get a life preserver to them, because that person does not care if they also take the officer with them. And it's something we have to be aware of if you're looking to grab onto someone who wants to go off a building or off the bridge, that you're not going to solve their problem by losing your own life in that situation.
Right. Do you see a particular population that is more prone, that, you know, is to attempt or commit suicide?
As I mentioned before, it seems frustratingly unattached to each other, that it really is like lightning striking in different households.
You mean, what about...
It can be... Yeah. Any gender, any age. There is a little bit of a concentration, I feel, with people in their 20s, especially males.
Mm-hmm.
And the ones that we find after an event, that we just can't find much connection between them and anybody.
Well.
Maybe the last community they were really part of was in jail, and they haven't had good social supports at any point, and they seem... like they're just kind of floating in society. They're not really connected to anyone. And so there seems to be a little bit of a surge in that area.
And that would be circular, too, because the more miserable they became, the more degraded their social skills are and their energy is low, so they can't connect to other people. And then it turns around and then they feel more suicidal. And there would be certain individuals, I would say, who become disconnected, like, you know, young adult males.
Right.
There would be, you know, substance abuse. There would be mental illness. There would be poverty. There would be numerous factors that would all play into, you know, like fetal alcohol syndrome, a kind of failure. You can't hold a job. Numerous factors.
Just like substance abuse, the vaccine to so many of these problems are connection. Is that when people are part of a community and connected, they have a lot more resiliency, even when bad things happen to them. Because there are lots of people that go through terrible, terrible experiences and never become suicidal.
Yes.
Many of them seem to identify strongly with families or groups or congregations, something that gives them some sort of base.
Absolutely. And I have worked a lot in my private practice with incest survivors. And the ones who were either able to have grandparents or a mentor or a church family were much hardier and much better able to withstand the trauma of early childhood abuse.
I mean, with incest, it's the ultimate betrayal. And if you don't have a relationship that you can trust to replace that betrayal, then you're, again, just untethered. You're just like a balloon floating.
And then the male predominance, as you said, it's well, how did you say it? It's self-loathing turned inward.
It's self-rage turned inward.
Self-rage. And What I also worked with were eating disorders. So, yes, I absolutely saw in my practice that more males would be acting out violently, or violently trying to end their life, and teenage or young adult girls would be also acting inwardly but harming themselves but not killing themselves. So
right.
It was a different dynamic, you know, having to do with our socialized gender roles quite a bit.
Sure.
What about elder suicide? What about, you know, there's just been so much going on right now about death with dignity. Washington and Oregon have passed laws allowing, in some cases, the administration of a
sure.
fatal overdose for somebody who has a terminal illness. So what about, do you deal with that very much?
Well, I have dealt with it a little bit professionally, but the impact on me with elder suicide has been personal because my own father took his life 2.5 years ago.
Oh.
And I had been on the suicide prevention committee for years and not had a personal contact with suicide. And then my own father took his own life. And with him, it was very different from what I saw with troubled and enraged people.
Absolutely.
My father was an incredibly dignified, incredibly powerful man, and he took care of everybody, and he took care of everything. If it was the neighbors, if he had to weld a stock tank or practice vet medicine on a cow or load a grumpy steer into a trailer, he was always capable of doing everything. And I think when we got to the point that he was so terrified at the prospect of being in assisted living and so unwilling to start to become the one in the child role, the one who's being bathed and the one who's being taken care of, I think that it was just something he couldn't bring himself to do.
Mm-hmm.
And so he took matters into his own hands. And I was so shocked at what happened. I had just visited him a couple of months prior, and in hindsight, he said some things that led me to believe that he was had already planned this. But when I would press him for information, there is nothing like one of these blue-eyed German farmers to shut their mouth, and you are not getting anything more out of them. And I was the light of Dad's life, so he talked to me more than he talked to anybody, and he would not tell me what he meant by certain things he said. And it wasn't until after he took his own life I realized that when he told me, "I don't ever want to live anywhere but this farm," that he was foreshadowing something for me that was going to happen.
Well, he would understandably really want to spill the beans and talk to you and tell you, You're so
right.
close to him, but he knew he couldn't.
I would not have allowed it.
You would not have allowed it, and well, it could be disastrous.
And moved home.
Oh,
and
yeah, I mean,
there would have been all these things that he would have hated.
Of course,
and they all would have happened if I had known what his plans were. And you know, at first, I just couldn't wrap my mind around what happened. But it's like even what parents of a young person who's completed suicide have told me, you never really know why, but you become more okay with not knowing.
Oh, yes.
So you learn to live with it.
Has that been your experience?
Yeah. I can't ever condone going that way, but I understand
sure.
more of why he would do it.
Right.
And I know that, like, when his friend who was fighting cancer got so weak and went down to 80 pounds. And his wife told me that my dad was the only one that visited him regularly every day until he died. Because everybody else kind of fell away as it got too hard
sure.
to see what was happening to their friend. But my dad kept in there, and I knew I think that impacted him a lot more than maybe I understood at the time.
You mean caring for his weakening
right.
threat.
And,
oh,
and,
yeah,
and
seeing his
seeing
future.
Himself potentially go down that road. And And I think anybody above the age of 30 now has to be a little bit aware of how long current medical science can prolong life.
Absolutely.
Past you really enjoying it. And that can be terrifying.
I
toured a facility when I was up north once with the Criminal Justice Commission, and it was a beautiful facility. But I remember these two Native men who were in wheelchairs who basically couldn't move, and they were wheeled up to the window and parked there for however many hours that day. And while the medical care was beyond compare, I mean, very well done, I thought, oh, if I couldn't read, that would be torture.
Yes.
If I couldn't have something...
Right.
You know, in yes. my, you know, working with my mind, and if I was sitting there, I mean, how do you cope with that? And I think that this will become more and more of an issue, because medical care is doing nothing but advancing.
Often I wonder, when I'm doing things to keep me healthy,
right.
I may regret it sometime, because I could be having a very healthy heart but a very weak mind.
Oh, I think that's, we all hope that we're still sharp as tacks mentally, and my mother-in-law is 97.
Oh.
And she doesn't miss a beat.
Really?
She is completely sharp, and, you know, that's the future that I wish we could all have.
Too bad you don't have her genes.
I know. I'm married into that family.
You're married into it. Well, hey, I think this is a good time to take a little break.
Sure.
If you just joined us, I'm talking to Lieutenant Chris Sell, a member of the Juneau Suicide Prevention Coalition, as well as a police officer here in Juneau. We're talking about suicide and the role of the Suicide Prevention Coalition. So let's take a musical break now, and then Chris and I will be back to talk some more about the difficult topic of suicide. Thank you. Welcome back to Mind Over Matter. I'm Dr. Elaine Schroeder, and with me in the studio tonight is Lieutenant Chris Sell, a member of the Juneau Suicide Prevention Coalition, as well as a police officer here in Juneau. And we are exploring the dynamics of suicide and the role of the Suicide Prevention Coalition in Juneau. So let's talk about what the coalition does.
So the coalition works with a lot of resources that allow us to coordinate with the CARE line so that we try and make sure everybody knows that there's always someone to call.
Caroline, what's that?
Caroline, it's a hotline that gives people a place where they can get someone to answer the phone. It may not be in Juneau, but there's always someone to talk to.
So
our dispatchers have the Caroline. It's, of course, on websites. And it's important for us to make sure that people know that you can talk to somebody anytime, day or night, and it's not somebody that knows your family necessarily mm-hmm. or knows the people you work with, that's available, and that there's all of these resources out there to provide some support. There's also resources out there to support someone who's had a loss to suicide so that we can talk about making that person who's left more resilient so that they're not prone to making some of the same decisions, because we do know that suicides can run in groups and can mm-hmm. run in families. It's contagion.
It's role modeling, too.
It's role modeling. So there's that, even though our suicides can happen anywhere in any family.
Right. So do you have, okay, aside from the Caroline, do you have specific programs? I mean, you probably, well, obviously
we do a lot of training.
That's training
yes.
of?
We do trainings for people about how to talk to others about suicide.
Okay, adults.
We've done a lot of public training with, if you're concerned that someone might be considering suicide, how do you talk to them about that? Because we've kept this issue so shrouded in silence for so many generations that we really haven't given your average person the tools to know what to do. And so we're trying to improve that education. I think it was a fear for a long time that if you were talking to somebody who was despondent and you mentioned suicide, you would give them that idea.
Mm-hmm.
And they would be like, hey, that's a great idea.
I hadn't thought of that.
I'll go do that. And yet all of the research shows that that's not true. That's not a real danger.
Mm-hmm.
Instead, people who are very despondent have often thought about suicide. And by us, in our conversations with them, refusing to even mention that that might be something they're thinking, we're further stigmatizing
Absolutely.
Their
it's
own
so horrid.
Thought process.
I can't say the
it's
S
so
word.
It's so horrid. I can't right. even say this word to you that I'm so scared about.
Yeah.
And so, we've had this training for members of the public. We've had this training for JPD officers that when you think someone might be suicidal, how do you talk to them? And we've role-played that.
And how do you talk to them?
Well, the way you talk to them is very clearly, without using any euphemisms. If I was concerned about you, I would say, Elaine, are you considering taking your own life? Are you considering committing suicide? And then mm-hmm. if you said yes, I would say, have you thought about how you might do that?
Mm-hmm.
And to see how much you've thought about
it. So you're doing
an
assessment.
Actual plan. Doing
yeah.
an assessment. And to determine, so you said that you might do it this certain way. Do you have the means to do that? Do you have mm-hmm. that item or that ability to assess, you know, where they are? Because, of course, the more specific points that they can actually meet, the higher the danger with this person.
Of course.
And so we reach a point where I might say, you know, Elaine, I like you, but you can't leave. You have to stay with me, and we're going to go to the hospital and talk to some people there. Because at that point, I have every reason to believe you might act on that.
So if somebody calls you and says, my husband is suicidal,
right,
and you go over, do you do that assessment?
We do talk to him about that. We also talk to family members about what they've
said. Get background, because he could lie
and,
to you.
Right. And we see if we get to that Title 47 level,
yeah,
that for their own safety, we need to take them to the hospital and have them talk to a professional, because we're not doctors, so we can't do 100% assessment. We're working,
sure,
more like police officers do with, we have a reasonable suspicion, or maybe even that we have probable cause to believe this person is actually a danger to themselves.
Mm-hmm.
So now we're going to take it to a professional and have them check.
And what about the other side? It's not the assessment, but or you find that the person says, and the person, you're not in your role as a police officer, but more in the role of a teacher, a friend, even a parent, and the person does indicate suicidal thoughts. As part of your training, do you teach people what to do then?
Of course. We talk to them about, you know, you need to report this to a professional. If it's teenagers, we want you to go tell a responsible teacher. Adults, it's a good time to contact the police if they won't voluntarily go to the hospital with you for an assessment.
Mm-hmm.
That when someone is seriously contemplating committing suicide, that's real. And that's not something that you can punch them in the shoulder and say, oh, buddy, you don't mean it.
Mm-hmm.
Let's have a beer and it's going to be all mm-hmm. okay. You need to actually believe the person.
Mm-hmm.
Whatever they tell you, you need to take that at face value,
right,
and act appropriately as they're telling you the truth.
Well, I always felt when parents were confused, and understandably, because if they had a volatile teenager, they may hope against hope that the kid just wanted attention. And the way I put it is, if a kid is that desperate that he or she needs attention by claiming to be suicidal, you're okay to act on the possibility that they mean it.
Right.
Because either way, this is a very troubled kid and could definitely use some help.
Well, and we're not asking people to be mind readers. We're saying that whatever they say, believe them.
Take it face value.
Take it at face value, treat it as real, and act on it appropriately. Contact the people that you need to talk to. So we do have mental health clinicians that respond 24 hours a day to Bartlett Hospital, and they will come and talk to the person.
Yeah, yeah. Now, going back to groups or who, let's talk about at-risk groups.
Sure.
And I'm aware that certain stressors in a person's life can cause all sorts of problems.
Mm-hmm.
You mentioned earlier that there's a big correlation between drug abuse and suicide.
Drug and alcohol.
Drug and alcohol abuse,
yeah,
and suicide. And then also, last month I had a person come in and talk about the ACEs study.
Sure.
Adverse Childhood Experiences. So that definitely...
Very good information.
And
yeah,
that's very important information. And so growing up abused or neglected would definitely put you at higher,
absolutely,
risk for suicide. You're internalizing that sense of worthlessness.
Right.
And I've also read studies that growing up black in America increases your risk of suicide because of racism. It's just so hard to be black in this country. Being gay increases your risk of depression.
Sure.
I know it increases the risk of depression. It doesn't mean that depressed people are gay. It's just hard to be gay. And,
correct.
And, you know, picture being gay and black in Montgomery, Alabama.
Sure.
I mean, that would not be easy.
That's a tough road.
That's a very tough road. And the harder your life is, the more likely you are to, you know, internalize the messages.
Sure.
That you're worthless or that you're no good. And we talked about the incidence of Native suicide, especially in the villages, which is,
yes,
huge. And so here we have a higher than average rate. Wow, that really surprised me, because we're a very affluent community. But you know,
no, it did not surprise me a bit.
Tell me why.
We're double the national average, just because of the rate that we see it.
I'm surprised that that is the rate. But when I just said that we're an affluent community, it's affluence for a part of the population, and and poverty for another part of the population.
Sure. If you don't have money, Juneau's a really difficult place to live.
Yeah.
There's not a lot for you. Our housing on the lowest end of the economic rung has got to be $700-$800 a month.
Yeah.
And so you have to have money to be comfortable in Juneau. And one thing that our affluence has gotten us, helped facilitate us getting into, is things like the heroin epidemic.
Oh, of course.
Heroin's expensive.
Yes.
And we have a terrible heroin problem. And there's a strong link between drug abuse and suicidal ideation. The self-loathing all goes hand in hand with it. And so in that case, our affluence bought us that risk level as well. So, and of course, if money kept you out of suicidal incidents, we wouldn't have all these celebrity situations.
No, absolutely.
It can happen that way, but the drugs and alcohol, the substance abuse, really has a strong correlation.
And then you have to look under that and see what groups are more prone to drug and alcohol abuse and what reasons. And just like you say, there's no cookbook approach to an intervention. When you said SWAT approach, most of us don't know what the SWAT approach is. We picture guys in ball. In headgear and black uniforms.
Right.
Exactly.
And maybe it's because I had spent 8 years on the SWAT team that when I went onto the Suicide Prevention Coalition and we got all hung up on what do we do after a suicide? How do we respond? And we were trying to come up with a checklist. And we bogged down for probably about a year in just paralysis by analysis. We wanted a checklist, and we could not agree on the checklist, and everybody could think of situations that whatever we thought of wouldn't work. And so we came up with the idea, and I was glad to bring this idea to the coalition, that this is like a SWAT call-out, that when the call-out happens, we have tools, we have different things that we can apply to the situation, but we don't have a plan before the situation happens. The situation dictates what our plan is going to be.
Right.
So we started going into it with a much more open mind. And then when we went to a conference in Anchorage, I heard someone from another community who was working in postvention say, well, we're not terribly advanced like Juneau is. And I kind of looked behind me because I thought, who are they talking about? I mean, we had just barely gotten our training wheels off.
Really?
For postvention because we'd started this tactical response. But we found out it was the only thing that works because you cannot draw enough similarities between suicides to have a checklist you can roll out.
Right, okay. Right.
You just can't. And so what we found is that to respond to a suicide, what matters is having the right people at the table, people who are connected to services and who know what's going on in Juneau and can help us close down those 6 degrees of separation to get us to that person that was lost. And what matters is the staffing. Not the checklist. So we staffed it, and then we had these tools that we could take into the situation.
Yes, yes. I liked your point about how, you know, after somebody has just experienced the suicide of someone they love, that you don't go in with a referral, and here's your referral to the bereavement group, or here's your referral here.
I would have been offended. If someone had done that after I had lost my father, and probably would have treated him the same way I treated the real estate agent that showed up to try and list the farm the day after we had buried Dad while there was still a house full of company. So I did kind of revert to my country roots and just run him off.
Oh.
It was not pretty. My husband and brother just stayed in the house. They figured she's going to handle this,
she's
and we're not even going to watch.
Okay. Well, here's the originator of the Year of Kindness telling how she did what I think anybody in her place would do with a greedy realtor. And she was a realtor in the past.
And I used to be one.
Okay. We're going to take another short break and be right back.
stardust raining down on us and circles round the moon. Softly I hear you are singing a song but as yet to be born. The melody gently
Welcome back to Mind Over Matter. If you just joined us, I'm talking with Lieutenant Chris Sell, a member of the Juneau Suicide Prevention Coalition, and she is also a police lieutenant with the Juneau Police Department. And we've been having a discussion about various aspects of suicide. She's on the Suicide Prevention Coalition. And we're really looking at the dynamics of suicide. And as we wind up our show, I would like to ask you, Chris, what, in your personal opinion, is the best thing we could do as a community to reduce the incidence of suicide?
I think that suicide is so intertwined with so many other issues that people are struggling with, whether it's depression or abuse in their past or substance abuse, that we need to take a look at all the siloing we've done of our social services, because we have all of these groups of people and pots of money that are aimed at carving out that one issue from that person and fixing that one slice, whether they have 4 points on the ACEs scale or 7 points or 12 risk factors for having bad things happen to them. And yet, when you look at that population, it's all the same people.
Mm.
So I think it's very difficult when you have all of these agencies trying to serve a slice of what's going on with that person without working on the totality and the interrelationship with those. Now, there are some private groups and private businesses that have kind of seen the light with things like case management, like the Glory Hole has a young man that works with people and tries to work with every issue that's going on with that person.
Yeah.
Is it mental health? Is it physical health? Is it food support? Is it housing? And really starting with the person and then starting to work on what is going on with this person instead of looking at, okay, our issue in this agency or with this grant is X.
Yeah.
So now let's go find our clients for that.
And a beginning, I was just thinking architecturally, a beginning for that would be, of course, if you had a big social service, nonprofit social service building where all
right.
the offices were.
Right. Where you have the resources, but they're not so divided.
Yeah.
That you've got different agencies that are maybe not very effectively spending mm-hmm. their dollars because it's not a wraparound service for that person. It's like, how do we fix what's going on here?
Right.
Instead of how do we come at it from these six different angles, which is also very frustrating to navigate if someone already has challenges
mm-hmm.
and they're trying to seek some help so that they can start to think more clearly. And you're putting a burden on someone, let's say someone who's substance abusing.
Yeah.
You have to be off the substances for a while before you can even think clearly.
Right.
And so trying to seek your own support that you need is very difficult
mm-hmm.
in that. So it's the efficiency that I think that we could improve,
yeah.
that we've got good tools.
Mm-hmm.
We're just not applying them based on that person.
Great.
We're That's applying them based on the issue.
And it's interesting that the glory hole has that model.
Yeah, and I think that it's just out of necessity and logic.
Sure.
Is that the glory hole doesn't have a ton of resources.
And people live at the glory
right.
hole. And so there's just more of a sense of the focusing on the whole person.
It's like how you would treat one of your kids.
Yes.
When you looked at them,
oh, yeah.
you wouldn't see an issue
no.
that needs to be addressed.
You'd see a kid.
You'd see a kid, and maybe they have these certain challenges.
Yeah.
And you would be thinking about that in totality of
yeah.
that person.
Yeah. Oh, well, Chris, your big overview, your big picture is so useful, and it's time to wrap up. I would really like to thank you, Chris. Sergeant Chris Sell of the Juno.
I'm actually a lieutenant, but that's okay.
Oh, yeah. Wait, what did I call you?
Sergeant.
Why did I call
Which
you
is
that?
Fine.
You know, I researched it.
I had a lot more fun
okay.
as sergeant.
Okay. Sorry about that. Lieutenant, I keep calling you sergeant. Lieutenant in the Juno Police Force and Suicide Prevention Coalition member, but thank you for sharing your experiences and knowledge about the issue of suicide and its prevention and its aftermath. And then sitting on my right are John and Dolly Kremers, who besides biking and hiking and swimming all over the world and being knowledgeable about many cultures, there are my master technicians who have assisted me for decades, it seems. So good night to all of our Southeast Alaska listeners. Please tune in on another Monday night next month at 7 p.m. to KTOO for another edition of Mind Over Matter. Good night.